Big news! Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here. Right now, score up to 80% off everything home. These are our best deals of the year. Shop Wayfair's Black Friday sale now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. What in the hell happened here? That seems to be the question that the original investigators never bothered to ask about the horrific crime scene on 10th Avenue. The Gary PD was so quick to close this case with an arrest that they never really bothered to figure out exactly what happened to Anthony Jeffers, Suzanne, and Angela Wallace. This case offers a crystal clear demonstration of the difference between an evidence-driven investigation and a suspect-driven investigation. The distinction is defined exactly the way it sounds. In a suspect-driven investigation, detectives have already found their guy, and once they know who did it, then the focus shifts to building a case around that person. They're no longer trying to figure out what happened, they're trying to create enough probable cause to warrant an arrest. Here's a good hypothetical example of the difference. Let's say someone was shot and killed in their home at the end of a cul-de-sac in a middle-class neighborhood. In an evidence-driven investigation, detectives might check every house on the street to see if they have Ring camera videos of any people or vehicles traveling down the road around the time of the murder. They would then use that evidence to establish a list of persons of interest that they would want to speak to. But in that same scenario, a suspect-driven investigation would look very different. The detectives again would pull the surveillance videos, but this time they're not looking to see who was in the area at the time of the murder, because they believe they already know who did it. Instead, they're really only interested in whether their guy was around at the time. On an even more basic level, think fingerprints. Evidence-driven, run them through APHIS to see who they belong to. Suspect-driven, compare them to a suspect to see if it'll help build their case. You get the picture. This case is an egregious example of an investigative agency shifting way too early from evidence-based to suspect-driven. Almost immediately, in fact. And sadly, the result of that, besides the wrongful conviction of Chris Bynum, is that the Gary PD never actually figured out what happened that night, and much less, who actually did it. So that brings us to our job. All of you and me working together as a massive think tank. We have to gain a full understanding of the what and the how before we can even think about moving on to the who. We started that process last week when we broke down the medical evidence from the Ballfield crime scene. And we're going to continue on today by doing the same with the triple homicide scene at Suzanne Wallace's house. I believe that there's a lot we can learn about this scene by analyzing the bullet trajectories alone, on top of the other details from the autopsies. The big question that I'm hoping to answer is, how many shots were fired that night? That information could help us determine how many guns were used, which can lead us to how many offenders were there. It's a lot to unpack, so let's jump right into it. We're going to start out with the least complicated autopsy, and that would be Dr. Kim's report on Angela Wallace. Starting out with the basics, Angela is described as a well-nourished, white, 24-year-old female in the autopsy. She was 5'1" and 146 pounds. She showed no indications of sexual assault, and for the most part, other than the gunshot wound, her external examination was unremarkable. There is one notable exception, which kind of leads us into the victimology portion of the autopsy breakdown. These are the data points that can help us get a better understanding of what Angela was doing before she was killed. This is where we hope to identify any potential risk factors. The autopsy reports that Angela had bruises on her left thigh and left arm, And it also notes that there's a, quote, old needle mark over her right arm, right in the crook of her elbow, like where you might get an IV. It's noted that it was covered with a Band-Aid. Now, Dr. Kim doesn't go into any great detail here, but note his use of the word old. It was an old needle mark. We don't know exactly what old means, but we hear more about needle marks later on one of the other victims, and the terminology he uses is different there. For Angela, my first thought was intravenous drug use. But after further examination, I doubt that's what's going on here. Kim stated that there was a Band-Aid over the mark. It's also on her right arm, and he only notes one single needle mark. If the mark was from self-injecting narcotics, I think that would likely mean that Angela would have to be left-handed. I don't know yet if she was, but that's something worth noting for later. The fact that there's only one single injection site leans me away from drug use as well, unless this was the one and only time that Angela ever shot up. And the Band-Aid just doesn't really jive with that situation either. I think most likely the needle mark came from a recent hospital visit. That tracks pretty well with a single needle mark covered with the Band-Aid. But while we're on the subject of drug use, let's jump into Angela's toxicology report. Angela's tox report detected only one drug in her system when she was killed. Cocaine at 281 micrograms per liter. No THC, no alcohol, and also, notably, no cocaine metabolites. And that little detail is more important than you might think, and I'll explain why at the end of this episode. The nuts and bolts are that cocaine detected means that she had used the drug within 30 to 90 minutes of her death, whereas metabolites would indicate that she had used it within 1 to 2 days of death. I also want to point out, just so everyone is clear, that cocaine in the blood could be the result of snorting cocaine powder, smoking crack cocaine, or less likely but possible, dissolving the powder into liquid form and shooting it up intravenously. The only other element of the autopsy that can really give us any insight into what Angela had been up to prior to her death is the gastrointestinal examination. Her stomach contained undigested gray tan semi-liquid food. This is the same thing that we found in Sheila in last week's episode, and just like Sheila, the stomach contents tell us that Angela ate something within 1 to 2 hours of death, probably closer to an hour. Now, in Sheila's case, that finding could be significant because we have a 2-hour window of unaccounted for time between leaving Michelle's house and being killed. With Angela, it doesn't really help as much. As far as we know, she never left the house that night, so the fact that she ate something prior to death is sort of irrelevant. But still, we note it because we never know what details will become important later. Now it's time to move on to the critical part of Angela's autopsy, the injuries section. The first step in figuring out what happened that night is going to have to be determining, one, how many shots were fired, and two, what caliber guns were used. We learned last week that the claim that all shots fired at both scenes came from a .38 caliber is really nothing more than a hypothesis. Liz was shot through the chest with no specified diameter for the entry wound, and that shot traveled completely through her chest cavity, broke through a rib, and exited the body with no bullet recovered. There is absolutely no way to use that data to come up with a theory of a .38 caliber bullet. It would be nothing more than a guess, and really not even a good guess. So we already have at least one strike against the .38 caliber theory, and in the house crime scene, we have a total of 9 bullet wounds to work with. So let's get started. Angela was shot 3 times. The first wound described entered into her right temple. The entrance wound was 3/8 of an inch, which is consistent with a .38 caliber round. The shot entered her right temple, broke through the skull, passed through the brain, and fractured the skull on the other side, with the fragments of the bullet coming to rest against the skull but still within the brain tissue. Trajectory was right to left. All of that is consistent with a shot to the side of the head with a low-velocity .38 caliber round. For context's sake, this is why I hypothesized that the shot to Sheila's head, over at the ball field, must have passed through something else first. That shot left a half-inch to three-quarters of an inch diameter entry wound, and the bullet completely broke apart within the brain and never made it to the skull on the other side. If they were both fired from 38 caliber rounds, then something had to have slowed that bullet down and deformed it before it hit Sheila. The second wound described in the autopsy is a shot to the right back of Angela's head. This one has powder burns and the skull is fractured around it. That indicates that the barrel of the gun was basically pressed against her head when the shot was fired. You have the damage from the bullet as well as damage from the percussion of the shot leaving the barrel. And again, we have a 3/8 inch diameter entrance wound. The bullet breaks through the skull, passes through the brain, and embeds within the skull in the temple region of the left side of Angela's head. The wound track is right to left, upward, and slightly frontward. Basically, it went in just above and behind her right ear and embedded in her skull just above and in front of her left ear. The bullet was basically intact. Dr. Kim notes that, quote, a medium-sized projectile, lead with jacket, was recovered, end quote. So that's two shots to the head, both consistent with a 38 caliber. Both broke through the skull, passed through the brain, and fractured the skull on the other side. One embedding in the bone of the skull, and one ending up in fragments against the inside of the skull. Consistent with each other, but not consistent with a shot to Sheila's head at the ball field. The third gunshot wound also entered on Angela's right side. This one entered her body about 1 1/4 inch in front of her right earlobe. The bullet broke through the hinge of her lower jaw on the right side, passed through her face, breaking teeth in the upper and lower jaw, and exited out the left side of her chin. The entrance wound measured 3/8 inch by 1/4 inch in diameter. A typical entrance diameter created by a 38 caliber on skin is roughly 3/8 inch, but don't let the 1/4 inch element here throw you off. Because of the angle of the shot and the elasticity of the skin, this wound is in fact consistent with a 38 caliber. There was no bullet recovered in this wound. In tracking the number of shots fired, this is what we know so far. There's no question that Angela was shot three separate times. The right temple, the back right side of her head, and on the right side of her face. There are no powder burns on the right back head wound. There are significant powder burns on the right temple shot, and minimal powder burns on the right face shot. So back of the head from at least a couple feet away, face from very close, and right temple with the muzzle basically pressed against her head. The bullets were recovered from the two headshots, and the bullet from the face shot passed through and was not recovered. So let's make sure that we're keeping track of all the bullets. So far, we have two accounted for and one missing. In Bertozzi's testimony a few weeks ago, we learned that he found three spent bullets at the scene as well as a couple of lead fragments. One of the bullets was found on the other side of the room over by Anthony's body. One was found on the living room floor, and one was found on the red blanket by the couch. It doesn't really matter exactly where, other than we can assume the one over by Anthony isn't the one that passed through Angela's face. We're more interested in numbers at this point. So let's go ahead and assign the one described as being a spent, deformed bullet on the living room floor to the shot through Angela's face. Think of this kind of like an audit. So far, we have three gunshot wounds and three bullets to reconcile them, and two spent rounds left that are still unassigned. Hey everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads. Next, we're moving on to Suzanne Wallace, Larry's mother and the owner of the house. Suzanne is described as a well-nourished, white, 34-year-old female. She was 5'6" and 208 pounds. Remember, Suzanne was still breathing when the police arrived on scene. She was transported and treated at the hospital. The external examination indicates that she had vomit and blood in her nose and mouth. Other than that, the external examination is pretty much unremarkable. She did have needle marks like Angela, but they're explained in the report. There are needle marks in the crook of her left elbow and the right chest wall, quote, from IV procedures performed at the hospital, end quote. Just as a reminder, in Angela's autopsy, the needle marks in her arm were described as old and covered with a Band-Aid. Suzanne had bruises on her left foot and left arm, and there was no indication of sexual assault. And her tox report looks pretty much just like Angela's. The only thing found in her system was cocaine at 237 micrograms per liter. No cocaine metabolites, no alcohol, no THC. Now let's move on to the gunshot wounds. Suzanne also has three of them. One to the right front side of her head, one to the right side of her face, and one to the right forearm. Remember, our goal is to determine the total number of shots, and that gets a little complicated with Suzanne. The question that I had was if the wound to the forearm could have come from the same shot that entered her head or face. And to answer that question, I tapped into an expert resource, my son Quentin. Quint is currently in his third year at Michigan State University studying video game design and development. One of his specialties is 3D animation. I gave him all the important information that I'm about to share with you about these wounds along with the autopsy photos and had him use the wound tracks to see if it's possible that one shot created two of these wounds. I'll circle back to his findings in just a minute, but first let me give you the details. Wound number one entered the right temple area of the head. The entrance wound is 3/8 of an inch in diameter and had no powder burns present. The bullet passed through the skull and through the brain. Dr. Kim notes that the round caused, quote, extensive lacerations to the brain. It fractured the left side of the skull and a, quote, large-sized projectile was recovered between the scalp and the skull on the other side. So that's one shot with the bullet recovered. So if you're keeping track, that's four shots total and four bullets. So we're still in balance at this point. Wound number two is the shot to the right side of Suzanne's face. This one enters at around the area of the cheekbone, just below it actually. The entrance wound is 3/8 of an inch in diameter, and there are muzzle marks and powder burns present. This is consistent with a .38 caliber shot fired at point-blank range. Since there are powder burns on this one, we know that this round did not pass through anything else first. The bullet went straight from the barrel into the face. This shot was fired downward into Suzanne's face. It passed through her jaw and mouth, and the bullet was recovered inside of her neck. So that's now 5 shots with 5 bullets recovered. Next up is the third wound. This one passes through Suzanne's right forearm. The entrance wound on the outside of her forearm measures 3/8 of an inch in diameter. It passed through the soft tissue, barely grazed the edge of her bone, and passed out of the body through the crook of her elbow, and no bullet was recovered. Now, the way I see it, there are 2 possibilities as to where that bullet went after passing through Suzanne's arm. Either it's one of the 2 remaining bullets that were found on the floor, or it passed through her arm and entered her head. This was the first set of wounds that I tasked Quentin with lining up for me. I had him put the 2 bullet trajectories into a 3D model of a body and see what position they would have to be in order for them to line up. What he came up with is definitely a reasonable possibility. If you go to our website, I put the animation he created into the case documents folder for this episode so you can get a visual rather than just my words. Essentially, the arm and head would line up if Suzanne was laying down on the mattress on the floor, propped up on her left elbow, and looked back towards the door over her right shoulder. If she held out her right hand as if to shield herself from the shot, the trajectories line up perfectly. The shot could pass through her forearm into the right side of her head and come to rest on the left side of the skull. 1 shot, 2 wounds. Quinn's model proves that this scenario is possible, but it doesn't prove that that's what happened. Remember, we still have 2 more spent rounds to account for on the floor, so we'll have to circle back to this one for confirmation after we examine the wounds of our third victim, Anthony Jeffers. As of right now, we have 6 wounds and 5 bullets, with 2 more spent rounds still unassigned. Anthony, or Amp, is described as a well-developed, nourished black male, 35 years old, 5'9", and 149 pounds. Amp's tox screen shows 10 milligrams per deciliter of ethanol. In terms that we're familiar with, that converts to a blood alcohol level of 0.01. To put that into even more simple terms, Anthony wasn't drunk, not even close. In most states, you're considered legally impaired at 0.08. At 0.01, he wouldn't have been feeling any effects from the alcohol at all at the time of his death. But just like with Angela and Suzanne, cocaine was detected in Amp's system. Just like with the other 2, no cocaine metabolites were present. Anthony had only 46 micrograms per liter of cocaine in his blood, which is pretty low compared to Suzanne and Angela, who both had over 230. And again, this is a detail that will help us paint a picture at the end of the episode. Now let's move on to Amp's gunshot wounds and see if we can put all of this together to figure out how many shots were fired. The first shot described in the autopsy is very clearly the final shot. The shot enters the back right of the head. The entrance wound is 3/8 of an inch in diameter, and there are powder burns present. This was a close-range shot to the back of the head. The bullet went through the skull and brain and exited out through the right upper eyelid. The shot completely severed the brainstem. Death would have been instantaneous from this one. Now, if you remember back to the crime scene episode, Anthony's body was found face down with his head against the wall. It looks very much like he had tried to get away, like he stood up and he was shot point-blank in the back of the head, and he collapsed and died immediately. This bullet passed completely through Amp's head without a bullet recovered, but remember, there was a bullet found right there on the floor by his body. So we're going to assign that bullet to this wound. Keeping track, that brings us to 7 shots and 6 bullets assigned. We still have 1 remaining unassigned bullet from the floor that could have passed through Suzanne's arm, but we haven't made that determination yet. We still need to examine Amp's other 2 gunshot wounds to close the loop. Anthony's second wound, as described in the autopsy, is a shot just in front of his left earlobe. Again, we have a 3/8 inch diameter entrance. There are no powder burns or stippling on this one. The wound track is at a downward and inward angle. The bullet entered in front of the left earlobe, passed downward through the jaw, and the bullet was recovered in the left side of his neck. The extreme downward angle, in my opinion, indicates that Anthony most likely had his head down when the shot was fired. Based on the crime scene details, I believe he was sitting down and probably put his head down, kind of wincing away from the shooter. If you can imagine you're in a seated position and someone is pointing a gun at your face, you might put your head down and turn away from it. That would be a natural reaction. You might also instinctually put your hands up in front of your face, which leads me to the final wound, to Anthony's wrist. At this point, we have 8 wounds and 7 bullets assigned. We still have that one spent copper jacket from the floor that we don't know what to do with, and now we're adding a 9th and final wound. The 3rd wound on Amp's body was a through-and-through shot to the left wrist. The entrance wound is on the outside of the forearm, 1¾ inches above the wrist, and it's 3/8 inches in diameter. This bullet did not hit any bone. It passed through only soft tissue and exited the inside of the wrist with no bullet recovered. So that leaves us with 9 total wounds and 7 bullets assigned and only 1 bullet unassigned. We have 1 more gunshot wound than we have bullets. So I had Quentin go through the same process with Amp's wound that he did with Suzanne. He built a 3D model and adjusted the body position to see if the trajectory of the left wrist wound could align with the trajectory of the wound that traveled from just in front of the left earlobe and down into his neck. His conclusion was that the wounds perfectly align if Amp was in the position that I described a few minutes ago, sitting in a chair, flinching away from the shot while raising his arms to protect his face. There's a video of the model posted on our website, just like the other one, for you to take a look at. Given the missing bullet and the fact that the wrist shot only passed through soft tissue, I think that this is exactly what happened. 1 shot, 2 wounds. I think Amp was sitting down when he was first shot through the wrist and into his face and neck. The blood pool on the floor under where his left arm would have been indicates that he remained in the chair for at least a few seconds after the first shot. He then got up and made it a step or two before the killer put the gun to the back of his head and ended Amp's life. Putting this all together, if we circle back to Suzanne, I think it's clear that she was shot 3 separate times. Once in the forearm, once in the side of her face, and once in her temple. The missing bullet from the forearm wound has to be the last remaining round found on the floor, which leaves us with a total of 8 shots fired, resulting in 9 wounds. Angela was shot 3 times in the head. Suzanne was shot once in the forearm and twice in the head, and Anthony was shot once through the wrist into his face and once in the back of the head. All entrance wounds are consistent with a .38 caliber round, and 8 shots means that, in all likelihood, we're either dealing with 2 guns or a reload mid-attack. And besides what I've already said about why I find a reload unlikely, what I'm about to tell you next all but confirms to me that there were 2 shooters. Let's circle back to the toxicology reports. When I started analyzing all the data for this episode, I really thought that the revelations would come based on the number of shots and the trajectories of the bullet wounds. As it turns out, we were able to determine that there were 8 shots fired and not 9, but that's not really all that significant in the grand scheme of things. 6 shots would be a big discovery. That eliminates the need for a reload or a second shooter. But 8 still leaves us in limbo. But the big reveal actually comes from the tox screens. Let me explain. I told you earlier that all 3 victims had cocaine in their bloodstream, but none of them had cocaine metabolites present. Here's why that matters. The effects of cocaine use, whether snorted or smoked, are immediate. It's an extremely fast-acting drug. So fast-acting, in fact, that the body starts to metabolize it almost instantaneously. And the metabolites are detectable in the blood within 5 minutes of use. And they will continue to be detectable for up to 2 days. Whereas the parent drug, cocaine, is only detectable for 30 to 90 minutes after use. The presence of cocaine and the lack of metabolites in all three victims tells us that all three of them used cocaine in some form within 5 minutes of being killed, and they hadn't used the drug in the 24 hours prior. That is not a coincidence. I described this scene in a previous episode as a blitz attack. At the time, it looked to me like someone barged in the door and just started shooting. But that does not appear to be what happened here at all. Whoever killed Amp, Angela, and Suzanne didn't burst through the doors with guns blazing. They were invited in. The killers didn't murder these three people because of a drug debt. They brought them the drugs and were right there in the living room with them as they got high. Let's take things a step further and really break this down. The living room is cluttered and there are no clean flat surfaces that I can see. Nowhere where someone is likely to snort cocaine off of. And there was no cocaine, none at all, found in the house after the murders. I think this all points to this being crack cocaine that was smoked out of a pipe. And now, let's look at the levels in the victim's blood. Angela and Suzanne, who were both laying next to each other on the floor, both had levels around 250 micrograms per liter, which research shows is the normal range for a single average-sized dose of crack cocaine within a couple of seconds to minutes of administration. Like I said, the drug hits quick. It takes less than 5 minutes for the cocaine to permeate the bloodstream and start metabolizing. Anthony, however, only had a level of 46 micrograms per liter. That's way too low for even a modest hit of crack. And I know I'm really in the weeds here, so let me just tell you what this all means. Anthony, Suzanne, and Angela were just hanging out in their living room that night. If Larry's right and someone did stop by earlier, it seems very likely that the visit wasn't an argument. More likely, the visitors left with a promise to return with drugs, which would explain why the three were still up so late on a weeknight. No one was smoking pot or doing drugs during that time. Amp maybe had one beer, but not enough to even feel it. They were just hanging out. Then finally, around 2 a.m., their visitors returned. Based on the tox screen levels, I think a crack pipe was passed around. Angela and Suzanne hit it first. Then it was handed to Amp, who was sitting on the other side of the room. Right as Amp started to take a hit from the pipe, the shooting started, before the drug could even fully enter his system. Whoever did this went to that house with a plan to kill Anthony, Angela, and Suzanne. It wasn't a blitz attack. They brought them drugs, let them all hit the pipe, and then immediately massacred all three of them. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.